We will be finishing Matthew 17 today and moving on into chapter 18. Pretty much everything we are looking at that Jesus himself says is, I believe, to be examined and absorbed and appropriated and re-examined and reabsorbed. And once again, I say, with freely admitting that it's true of my life as well, that so often we wear his name and ignore his words. And we act like they are suggestions that are basically impractical in the world that we live in today, and we forget that he's the creator and he's the designer, and what he says, this is the way to live. He wants to bless us. He wants our lives to be what they were designed to be. And whenever he says don't do this, he's saying don't hurt yourself. And we just always need to hear that. Romans 15:4 says that everything that was written, that God allowed to be recorded in Scripture, was written to teach us. And we can learn even from the foolishness of the disciples, though we laugh at their foolishness. There's a little bit of an edge to that laugh, isn't there, when you look at your own life and you realize, I am exactly like that sometimes. And that's why I always point out that though they were slow to learn, though they would seem, you know, to quote Everett, dumber than a bag of hammers sometimes, he didn't fire them. He kept repeating himself. He knew that however they started out, he knew what they were going to turn into when he worked in their life. And I find comfort in that, because that's the way he treats me as well, and the way he treats you. And I don't need to tell you, if you've lived in this world very long, there's nobody really that loves like that in this world. Maybe your mom. I didn't have one, so I don't know, but nobody loves in the way that God does. And so we can learn from even their foolishness. We certainly can learn from the response of Jesus to their foolishness, what kind of a heart he has. So there are great things to learn, even when you wince at what you read. We stopped last week. We spent a great deal of time in Mark's account of this, because he was so much more colorful. He took better notes. Matthew's account was really sketchy. If you weren't here, please pick up the CD for that. I know it was a blessing to me, looking at the power of our King and learning a little bit about our enemy as well. But we stopped at the end of Matthew's, at the discourse, verses 22 and 23 of chapter 17, with two back-to-back statements that seemed to me to be absolutely mutually exclusive, a complete contradiction to one another. Jesus told them, for what I think we figured was the fourth time consecutively, that he was going to suffer and die. He said who was going to do it. He said that it was going to result in his death. And then he said after 3 days, he was going to rise from the dead. That's about as clear of information as you possibly could need. And then the next statement of verse 23 says, and the disciples were filled with grief. And you think, what? If he'd have just said he was going to get beat up and die, that would be one thing. But he told them he was going to rise from the dead. He told them how many days, and they were filled with grief. It just didn't penetrate. And I find myself scratching my head until I remember how many times Jesus has had to remind me of things that were meant to encourage me and prepare me. And I needed to hear it more than once before I actually applied it to the situations of my life. So Jesus blows me away. I just love his heart. I love that he repeats himself. So we're going to pick up at that point. Matthew 17:24, and we'll finish 17, and then we will get probably only as far as verse 7 or 8 in chapter 18. These are really huge things that he's talking about in chapter 18, and I don't want to rush them. So, Lord, please give me words more than my own. Please open the hearts of the hearers as well. After verse 24, after Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax, that was a temple tax, not a governmental tax, the collectors came to Peter and asked, "Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax or the 2 drachma tax?" It's worded in Greek in the negative, which means he didn't, or at least they had no record of it. He's not asking whether or not he did. They're coming from the position of he doesn't, does he? According to our records. And of course, Peter, good old Peter, you know, Peter, not knowing what to say, said, "Yes, he does." Of course, that was not true. You can almost see Peter saying, "Yes, he does. I'm pretty sure he does. I think I might have even seen him there one time. I'm relatively positive, according to my recollection." You know how it is. No, he just blurts it right out. "Yes, he does." I love this next interchange. You're about to see the third time in a week that God has to interrupt Peter. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. The Greek is very clear. Jesus prevented him from speaking. And I write in my margins of my Bibles right there, mercy. Not letting Peter dig himself in any deeper than he already is. Jesus was the first to speak. "What do you think, Simon?" "What do you mean? I'm not Rocky anymore? I'm not Peter the Rock? What do you mean, Simon?" He was acting a lot more like a Simon, wasn't he, than a Peter the Rock. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their own sons or from others?" "From others," Peter answered. Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are exempt. But so that we may not offend them, go to the lake, throw out your line." The Greek is more specific. "Throw out your line with the end of the hook on it." It's a specific word. It's the only time in the New Testament it's used to describe fishing. Every other time, fishing involves the throwing of a net. So it's kind of an important thing for detail guys like me. "Go to the lake, throw out your hook and line, and take the first fish you catch and open its mouth, and you will find a 4 drachma coin." Apparently Jesus knows how to add. "Take it and give it to them for my tax and for yours." So, that's one separate incident we'll talk about, but I want to keep reading and then we'll go back and look at the details. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" At what time? Well, you have to rewind a couple of weeks to realize 3 of them had just been invited for a special makeover for Jesus. I mean, a special revelation, something no human being had ever seen. They were invited, and the other 9 stayed behind. The other 9 stayed behind. Remember last week we looked at the fact that somebody came with a need, and they were so out of it they couldn't meet that need. So God, this is just sibling rivalry waiting to happen. 3 privileged kids, 9 kids who just had their failure shown in front of everybody. And so how do guys deal with that? Well, they either arm wrestle, or they have a drag race, or they argue about who's the greatest. You can just see it. You can just see it. "Oh, I had a great time up on the mountain. Too bad you guys couldn't come. Well, yeah, that's because you're the problem children. That's how I'm coming. You can't let you out of his sight. You can just see it happening. So look how Jesus dealt with it. He did it, dealt with it in a way that he often did, because that was a common argument with them. He just gave him an illustration. He called a little child, and he had him stand among them. And he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. They were arguing about who's going to be vice president. And he says, you are so off the page. Unless you change and become like little children, you won't enter the kingdom. Who's he talking to? He's talking to his followers, not pagans. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. That's what we're going to talk about today, most of our time. We'll read all the way to verse 7. Whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. And, of course, the operative phrase in there is the phrase, in my name, which is greatly misunderstood in our culture. But if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me, my NIV says to sin, but that's, I think, a bad translation. Some of the other translations say to offend, it offends one of these little ones who believe in me, or causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble. That's closer to the Greek word. It literally means to throw someone off course into ruin. It's not the normal word for sin. So I'm going to read it that way. If anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to be thrown off course into ruin or to stumble, it would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the man through whom they come. It's a fallen world. Bad stuff's going to happen. But the people that cause it are still accountable. And I think those are sobering words. By the way, the word woe that's used twice there is a word of grief. It's not a curse. It's a word of grief. And that's as far as we'll get. Next week we'll talk about radical surgery, how you deal with things in your own life that cause you to stumble. But I just don't think we have time to get all the way through that today, and that's too big of a subject to water down. So that's, we'll just get as far as, verse 7 today. So let's rewind back up and look at the end of chapter 17. Did I leave something out? I don't think so. I had about 3 pages worth of notes on how God feels about paying taxes. Of course, I will admit, I am a Republican, so I'm not that wild about the Republicans right now, to be honest with you, but I'm not that wild about taxes to begin with. And I was just getting up a really good head of steam as I was looking through my notes until I realized this is not talking about governmental taxes. And so I just had to toss all of that out because it doesn't apply. And that's always good for me when that happens. This is why I read and write my notes so often. And it does embarrass me about how many times I may have taught this before and not noticed that. But there are some good things for us to see. By the way, one statement in regards to paying taxes to the government. Jesus himself said, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Give to God what belongs to God. My accountant, who I've had for 32 years now, has his policy is give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and not one penny more and not one penny less. If I'm going to comply with what Jesus said I can trust God to provide for me when I obey him. I can't necessarily count on God providing for me when I willfully disobey him. But the temple tax is a completely different deal. As the NIV points out, it was a tax for the temple. It was levied every spring. It was half a shekel for each head of household. I don't know if you guys remember when you went to Israel, remember how big a half a shekel was? It was about, you know, just about the size of one of your fingernails, not a very big coin. But in that economy, that was quite a bit of money. And if you take the half a shekel for every head of household, that was sufficient, they believed, to provide for the support of the temple. But Jesus says some things here that are worth noting, that had I just gone through my notes and misapplied my notes, I wouldn't have never noticed. So I'm kind of, I got a lot of great stuff out of this, and I'm glad to pass it on to you. This whole interchange is interesting to me. I don't really think we have an equivalent in our culture. The closest would be that there are some denominations, I've never heard of this till I came to New England, but there are some denominations that charge dues. If you are a member of the church, you have to pay dues every year. And I don't even want to go where what I think about that, but membership is a different thing in that kind of case to a lot of people being a member of a church. In this church, being a member means you're somebody that belongs to Jesus, that has decided you believe what he's doing here, is you want to be part of it, and that's it. You don't sign anything. I'm not the police. I can't kick you out. It's just a different thing completely. I believe that it follows the biblical model better than charging dues. My brother had a fabulous statement about denominations one time. He says the only reason you'd have a denomination is so you can kick people out. Really, if our accountability and our love and our bond is because we love Jesus and we love each other, you don't really need to organize that. You organize it so that you have the authority to remove people, and I'm not sure I'm in favor of that. I think God's able to remove people. People tend to remove the wrong people, if you know what I mean. So, free little rabbit trail about membership, no charge for that. But this was a Jewish law. And I want to point something out to you that a lot of people forget. You see the interchange with Jesus a lot regarding his, not disrespect, but his lack of worship of the temple. He didn't disrespect it, but he did not give it the reverence that they did. And he was always getting in trouble for this. It was one of the things that they killed him for, what he said about their temple. And can I just point something out to you? That God never asked for a temple. The temple wasn't his idea. It was human idea. God didn't say, build me a temple. That was David's idea. David wasn't allowed to do it, so Solomon did it. And when Solomon dedicated it, there in, is it 1 Kings or 2 Kings? I think it's 1 Kings. When Solomon dedicated it, God said, well, you know, nice temple. I'm not going to fit here. I didn't actually need a temple. I know why you did this, and I'm just going to make you promise, just in honor of what you did, why you did it. He said, anybody that comes to this place that wants to talk with me, I'll meet them here. Basically, that was it. God didn't ask for a temple. So here's what I want to say. In this story, Jesus did not, as a rule, follow the rule in paying the temple tax. He wasn't on their list of one of the contributors. And tax people keep excellent lists and records. And it just brings up an interesting point for you to ponder and talk about on the way home in your Land Rover, or, you know, sitting around the table or whatever you're doing this afternoon, since the Patriots aren't playing for till tomorrow. Is God obligated to provide for religious programs and edifices that are not his idea? Just because ostensibly it has to do with religion and worship, is God obligated to provide for that? And my answer would be no, he's not. If it's not his idea, man, he's not obligated to give us one penny to take care of it. That, if it's our idea, then it's on our shoulders, which is why we try to not do anything without finding out whether it's God's idea. Because if it is God's idea, then he'll take care of us and we're okay, right? But you'd be surprised how that's not the natural reaction in the church world. The church world is, we have an idea, we have a dream, we have a program, let's get this going, let's build this building. If you build it, they will come, you know, that philosophy. And then we say, Lord, take up your cross and follow me. And then we go do our thing, and now we expect God to bankroll the whole project. And I think this is a precedent that when Jesus did pay this temple tax for Peter and for himself, it was for a completely different reason than that God was endorsing their idea about the temple. So if you don't agree with that, you're welcome to talk with me. But that was one of the things I got out of this short little episode. So verse 24, the collectors of the tax come up, and just the whole way they worded their question, doesn't your teacher pay? You can just, can't you just see the little piece of paper where they've checked off everybody's name? And they're going, now, there's this guy. He used to be a carpenter, now thinks he's a holy man, walking around the country, thousands of people come. We don't have his name on our record as ever having paid this tax. You wonder why Peter was so quick to say, yes, he does? Well, because Peter didn't pay his either. I'd love to tell you a story about somebody I talked to today, this week. They were an adult, but I recognized the expression on their face when I asked them a question and they were preparing to lie to me. And I recognized the look on their face because I have that look on my face 100 times, 100,000 times as a child when my parents asked me something and I didn't want to tell the truth. You know that split second of deer in the headlights look, the eyes widen, and you know the next words coming out of that mouth are going to be a lie. So I can just see Peter with that, what thing? Yes, he does. Pretty sure he does. Kind of, I know I didn't, but you know that whole thing, that whole forceful thing? So that's all that Matthew's account. I do think it's interesting that Matthew's the only one that mentions this. What did Matthew do for a living before he followed Jesus? He was a tax collector. This impressed him. Both the stupidity of Peter, and it's like, you can almost see Matthew including this saying, look, be sure your sins will find you out. Tax collectors are not stupid. Or maybe it was just impressive to him, the fact, the whole way that Jesus dealt with it. Yes, he does. And then I love this statement that says, when Peter came into the house, Jesus prevented him from speaking, is literally the way the Greek renders it. Peter, he says, what do you, no, it says, Peter came to the house, Jesus was the first to speak, and he says, what do you think, Simon? Do you have a special name that your parents call you when you're in trouble? Candy already told me that when she's called Candace, she knows she's in trouble. Robert, Marcus, call. I hear those words. I tremble in fear to this day. I'm 60 years old. Almost all of my parents are dead. It's just the name. Simon, is this like a major demotion? No, I don't think so, because Jesus was merciful. But you noticed an interesting thing. Every time Peter was in trouble, Jesus called him Simon. Every time he was visibly caught in the flesh, Jesus called him Simon. Why? I do know that when he addresses me in a certain way, he wants me to know that he knows where I am. That he knows I'm in rebellion or I'm trying to hide something, which is stupid. I mean, there's nothing stupider than trying to hide from God. I do find the whole thing, though, that Jesus spoke first. Maybe I'm reading something into this. I don't know. This whole thing was a new discovery for me this week as I'm studying these few verses. I think it's mercy.